This podcast is brought to you by ORCHSE Strategies, an industry leader in developing innovative, sustainable approaches for protecting workers and the environment. And a big thank you for their sponsorship to the Pre-Accident Podcast. ORCHSE's main focus and passion is in fostering EH&S performance excellence in all their companies. When members participate in one or more of ORCHSE's 9 different specialized networks, or if they engage in one of their task force or working groups, something very special happens. The sharing of ideas frequently results in cutting-edge solutions that have practical applications immediately. For example, ORC has been at the forefront of efforts to create new approaches for fatal and serious injury prevention and has helped plan, conduct, and create conferences on human and organizational performance. If you're interested in learning more about the unique opportunities available through ORCHSE, please contact our buddy Linda Haney at 202-510-0509. Or if you'd rather pop her an email, it's linda.haney, L-I-N-D-A dot H-A-N-E-Y at ORCHSE.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast.
And I will fill up a nice day with hard work, and I don't know why I keep doing it.
Do you think it's because A, there's a lot of work right now in your world, and B, because the work you do is important?
It's neither one of those.
Well, I was trying. Hi, everybody. Todd Conklin, and this is the Pre-Accident Investigation Podcast. How are you today? I cannot believe it is almost the end of October. I don't even know what to think about being the end of October. It's crazy. I've been on a great trip. Just spent a couple days with Mississippi Lime and those guys. And amazing, always amazing to see that kind of excitement and improvement. And they're just getting better and better and better and better. And so are you guys. I mean, it's there everywhere. It's fall, and at least in the United States, it's fall. And fall is my favorite time. It smells good. The air's crisp and clean. The mornings are bracing. At least in Santa Fe, the afternoons are gorgeous. Although, I've got to be here more. What am I doing? This is crazy. I'm spending my life sitting in seat 21C, you know, near the toilet in the back of a plane bumping around across the United States. But I guess that is what it takes to get the message out. Hope you're doing good. Today's podcast is really interesting. I say that a lot, I know. Maybe I guess because I really believe it is really interesting. But I've become fixated with the line between workplace violence and safety, where once I think we thought workplace violence was kind of an HR problem or a site security problem or a leadership management problem, I'm realizing that it has just incredible impact to sort of how we do our work. And I've always been fixated in this, and I've been lucky because I've had the opportunity to work with lots of people in this area. The recent big events that have happened, the workplace violence events, and the violence events in total, I think, are curious to me. And they're curious because I think we can take a classic sort of bad actor free agency approach to it, or we can look more at a systems approach to understanding kind of why these things are happening. And that's kind of what we're going to do today. It's not short. It's a full-size podcast, but it's a short discussion on that very notion of threat assessment, violence, workplace violence. And my buddy Mark McElhaney is going to have that conversation with us. He's the expert. He's the dude in this area, and he's got lots to say about it. So without me blabbing on about October and fall and how much time I spend in seat 21C, let's jump into the podcast and see what you think. So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Mark McElhaney. So what's going on in the world?
What's going on in the world?
I mean, not in the world, because that would be like a 90-hour podcast. But what's why all of a sudden these shootings? Is there just more attention, or is there more uncertainty? Is there more unhappiness? Is these shootings are amazing to me. I'm freaked out by them.
Yeah. Well, I think there's several phenomena going on. And again, we always run a risk when we talk about why is this happening, because everybody's got a theory. And of course, unfortunately, theories are never about one particular answer, you know, like this is, and that's what happens in this field is that, or at least in our world, especially with politics, is that everybody likes to find a pet theory and promote it. You know, it's guns or it's not guns. It's, you know, this police. I mean, it's and back and forth. But I think there's several factors going on. One is that I believe in, at least in this country, in the United States, of addressing your grievances through going in and shooting up a place has now become a recognized way of doing things. I mean, not that it's acceptable, but it becomes a defined way of expressing yourself. And it happens frequently enough now. And I think that we will see probably an increase in frequency. I do believe that. I think that we're just, you know, we're really just kind of beginning in some ways.
Well, let's unpack that a minute, because I find that really interesting, because what you're telling me, and tell me if I've got this wrong, is that on the optional list of things you can do when dissatisfied, suddenly the idea of going in and shooting people has appeared as an option. It's not accepted. It's not right. It's morally decrepit, but it's now an option. Is that what you're saying?
That's a really good way of looking at it, quite frankly, because where it used to be A, B, C, D, and E, now we got this, and maybe F, shooting at the place, was way down, like kind of on the back page of something nobody would even consider. Now F is kind of in there, you know, for certain people with a certain state of mind, you know, who have certain belief systems, et cetera, you know. So, yes, I believe that that is the case.
But that seems highly discouraging to me, because I think you're right, and that scares the crap out of me. I mean, that it's a reasonable option to a person who's thinking wrong means that it would be really hard to prevent by simply asking people to not do it.
That would be correct, yes.
Yeah. But that's not so comfortable for me.
No, nor for me. And what it really means is that the rest of us have a more important job to do. In terms of recognizing those individuals who may be inclined to do it, recognizing when they are preparing to do it, recognizing when they are, you know, on the verge of doing it, and being able to do something about that in terms of reporting that, it means that we have to pay attention. But that's what society is all about anyway. I mean, I work in the field of workplace violence, as you know, and so people call me at the last minute. Which means that in they're paying attention to the violence. Basically, when someone starts to get violent or they're just about to become violent, they will suddenly call me. Whereas they were not calling me way before this, because when we start asking questions about it, we find that there's a long process of people who were engaged in actions and behaviors that were of concern to people, but they did not report it or do anything until they got close to an act of violence. And that's why I've even changed the title of what I do and the subject matter of what I do from workplace violence to dealing with high-risk behaviors, because the bottom line is that we're much better off when people are paying attention to what I call high-risk behaviors and dealing with that. Because, you know, the fact is that it's not just because we want to prevent workplace violence, but those high-risk behaviors are problematic in themselves. They're causing problems in themselves, but somehow they're problems that people don't feel the need to deal with, they don't have to deal with, they don't want to trouble with dealing with them, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that we as a society, in the workplace, the things that I talk about in the workplace, what we need to do to prevent workplace violence, is the same thing that all of us need to do in any community, which is pay attention to each other, you know, take care of each other, you know, watch out for each other. You know, notice when people are upset or going through difficult times. Notice when there's some strange, odd behaviors in people that normally don't show odd behaviors. Notice when someone may be suicidal, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, our society doesn't have a lot of safety nets automatic to deal with that. But at the same time, we've got to start that process first of paying attention. And I think we do need some safety nets. I think we do need some more mechanisms for responding to those high-risk behaviors.
So it's interesting you use the word high-risk behavior, because on my side of the house, on the sort of reliable systems and safety side of the house, we've sort of grown to the point where behavior is not sufficient enough. We've also had to look at context around the behavior. And in fact, what we've learned is that the context is oftentimes less emotionally charged to identify and observe, and that you really look for a context that could create the potential negative outcome, and that is probably a part of the behaviors that you see. So it's conditions plus behavior, not just behavior.
Right.
What do you think about that idea? Because that's a place where I think our two ideas can converge. You know, I don't just look for people who exercise risky behavior, although it's risky behavior is oftentimes retrospectively determined. You know, it didn't look risky until after they shot somebody. And then, oh, yeah, that totally made sense. Right. I remember when I first got a job and I lived in a quad, these two-story quads, and the next-door neighbor was a young couple. And the wife came out one morning, and she had two black eyes. And I said, oh, my gosh, what happened? And she said, I fell down the stairs. And I was like, well, that's terrible. You know, be more careful. Try to keep the stairs clean. It wasn't until 6 months later when the police came, and it was a domestic violence situation that actually ended quite horribly, that I realized there were lots of indicators, but I didn't have the context right. I mean, I sort of fell for the old fall down the stairs thing. When in reality, probably the indicator was pretty strong. Two black eyes is kind of sort of a big sign, but I missed it. What do you think about that?
Well, I that's exactly what I'm talking about. And when you talk about context, that's an interesting, and it may be a matter of semantics here to some degree too, because when I talk about behaviors, I tend to talk about a wide variety of things that may include seeing someone with black eyes. But you're right. I mean, bottom line is that a lot of times we're talking about indicators that are part of the context around behaviors. Now, it's a little easier, by the way, in my field, because when I'm trying to prevent violence, there are actual early behaviors that we can look at.
And I agree with you on that. And it's taken us 25 years. I completely agree with what you just said. It's taken us 25 years. Our big problem is that we thought behaviors were the key. Identify the behaviors and you solve the problem. What we realized is that behavioral recognition, that early detection, is much easier to do in retrospect. And so something bad would happen, we'd go back in retrospect and say, this was there, that was there, this was there. Let's now look for those three things. And you don't see them as much. It's been a really, it's been a very interesting growth curve for us, maturity curve for us, to sort of move away from solely seeing behaviors as an indicator to starting, you know, a more holistic approach to understanding that kind of threat. But I agree, when somebody says, I'm going to come back and kill you, that's a behavior. They said it. And it's relatively significant. It's a threat, and you've got to respond to it. So there's a real balance here for sure.
Well, you know, I know exactly what you're saying, because a lot of things that we look at in terms of high risk are more context and behaviors. And so I think that's going to be helpful to me. And we ought to talk about that in our workshop in May that we're planning. Is that because a lot of times I'm talking about, let's say, for an example, if we're about to terminate an employee who we're concerned about because there's already some high risk factors, and we find out that you know, his wife just died of cancer, he lost his home financially, and he basically made a statement the other day, his job's the only thing he's got left in the world to keep him alive, whatever. And so those are contextual kind of things when we talk about terminations, for example, we talk about, you know, if you have a high-risk person going into a high-risk situation, you need to stop. And we're talking about contextual kind of things, because he is about to enter a context where the risks are going to go up because of that environment. And you're right. I mean, that's exactly right. And again, I think there's another way that we can look at it, too, is that there are work environments that contextually may cause people to get themselves into a state where they don't have as many options, and you know those options, you know, where violence may become a higher level, and that's as a possibility because of the nature of the system.
How much does like social leveling, you know, fairness, justice, they treated me bad, therefore I will treat them bad. How much does that play into the work you do, especially in the threat assessment side of the equation?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because even though I preach, I say over and over again, there's lots and lots and lots of reasons that people can get violent, and we try not to have a list of the warning signs, because there's so many different things, and we have so many different scenarios and so many different types of violence. But if I had to tell you what is the most common variable in the hundreds of situations that we deal with every year, in fact, and it's probably involved in almost all of them, is a sense of injustice, of being treated unjustly. That is one of the more common ones. So, and again, which tells us, and by the way, a couple of other things we see a lot that may not be quite as obvious to many and may be counterintuitive, but we also see not only people that feel unjustly treated, but number two is that they feel somehow threatened themselves. These so-called threatening people are feeling just as threatened themselves, and it's kind of a response to that feeling. And thirdly, that they do not feel like there's any other options. Because when you take a violent act, sometimes it's because you do not feel like you have any other ways of expressing that. So that being said, that as someone who also manages people, tries to manage his anger down to a safe place, those are three things that I have to keep in mind. Number one is that I've got to make sure this first person, at least with me, feels like they've been justly treated, and then figure out some way to get some satisfaction on their part that they have a sense of justice, that they've at least been heard in the process and treated fairly. Secondly, I've got to somehow remove their sense of threat somehow. And finally, is hopefully help them find other options. So again, it kind of helps me manage the situation when I keep that in mind. But the sense of injustice is first and foremost many times.
That's remarkable, too, that notion of justice is so powerful in everything we do. And as a threat assessment tool, I mean, I think that, again, allows us to look at sort of the holistic approach, the condition approach, and it's less emotionally charged when you identify an environment where you clearly see where a worker feels like they haven't been treated fairly. It's interesting to me, Mark, and I would be curious what your response is. The days of saying the world famous quote, "he just snapped," seem to be over. You don't hear that anymore when you watch these horrific newscasts about these shootings. They don't say "he just snapped." You know, he was a real good guy, quiet, you know, kept weird pets, and he just snapped. I think society's understanding that this is a long-term condition, and that these behaviors are really the result of this whole series of contextual events that happened beforehand. How's that changed what you guys do?
Well, that's great to hear. I'm because that's what we've been preaching for so long, and because we have people in my field have never seen anybody just snap. It just does not happen. And it's great to hear from your perception that the public and the news media and everybody are getting that now, because you're right, we don't hear that as much, and that's been wonderful. And again, what we have to do is change people's behavior in terms of being able to recognize these early signs and being able to respond to them in ways so that we can deal with them early. But I want to go back a minute, because you mentioned something about sense of injustice. The most important thing, you talk about how to look at systems and what the systems impact. The most important thing that we do in my work, because I engage with these folks often, the people that are threatening or make threats, and and we get them down. 99% of the time, we're able to help them reduce that that anger and their sense of injustice, and get them to a place where we feel like they can safely walk away with their integrity intact. How do we do that? It's really, really simple. I mean, there's a lot of different ways we do it, but the number one thing that we do addresses their number one need. And everybody's number one need in any kind of difficult situation, any kind of crisis, in any kind of conflict, is to be heard and to have their views validated to a certain extent. A lot of times we go into a situation and we can de-escalate it, and people think what we do is magic, and really our secret is really quite simple. I mean, it really goes a long way just allowing people to express what they're feeling, express their injustice, and sometimes you can't solve it, but that alone is so powerful. And it then you go back and think, okay, why are they suddenly having to do this now? Why has that not been done before? What is it about this environment that person did not feel like anybody's listening to them? That's pretty significant just by itself.
So let me pull the string on that, because until we started having this conversation, I would have said you're a threat. Well, you are. I mean, I'm not making this up. You're a threat assessment expert. That's what you do, especially around workplace violence. But you're an expert at it. But now when I hear you talk, what I really hear you telling me you do is you really work on both sides of the crisis. You work on the threat assessment prevention side, but that's not complete enough. You also then work on the recovery and control side of it. So once a person is identified as a potential threat, you no longer really deal with threat assessment, obviously, because they're a threat already. But then you really work on the recovery side of the house. And it seems like the recovery side of the house is much more valuable. That seems to be where actually you can make a difference and de-escalate a situation. Is that fair?
Hey, yeah, that's very fair. I mean, and I would say that our company, Critical Response Associates, if I had to say what our core service was, it starts with threat assessment. That's how we get started. That's what the area is called. But frankly,
how do you do that? How do you do threat assessment like that? The starting ones.
Okay. Well, let me kind of finish that sentence, and then okay. I'm going to go to that one. What has evolved over the years of doing this is that very early in my career here, I realized that as soon as I'm sitting in front of somebody assessing the threat, I have an opportunity, because I'm interacting with that person, to reduce the threat. And so whereas it sounds like I'm first of all assessing threat and then we're managing it down, it ends up being a coexisting process where essentially I am managing it as I'm assessing it. So we end up going in to assess the case, and sometimes we end up walking away with the risk reduced. But it didn't start off that way. It was like through the interaction and through the assessment process, we're able to manage it down. So I kind of think that our main role most of the time is more risk mitigation than risk assessment. And that's how we've evolved over the years.
And I think
you'll have to tell me what that other question was, because I forgot.
Yeah, I'm sure it was brilliant too. No, but I think that's really a powerful thing you just said, is that the notion of threat assessment and threat response, or whatever word we want to use, identifying the problem and then managing the problem, aren't separate. They coexist. They exist at the same time. And I think that's a real maturity you bring to the process that I don't think people – I think there's a real bias to believe we can prevent these. That's why we have big discussions about gun control and mental health, and all those issues are really important, and we don't have solutions for them. But that's a bias towards believing that if we could prevent this, it would never happen. When in reality, what I think we do is we manage both the threat and the response simultaneously, and it probably happens informally all the time. I mean, it's probably constantly happening.
Well, I think what we do is we can manage this in order to prevent the ultimate consequences. I mean, the way I look at it in terms of an act of violence, I think we can prevent all of those. I mean, I really do. But We do it by managing this much earlier in the process so that the consequences, are not as severe.
So you don't see a violent actor as an outlier. You see them as the sum total of a context that put them in a sum total of a context and inappropriate coping skills or not sufficient enough coping skills that put them in a position where this result is just kind of a likely outcome?
Absolutely. I mean, I can say this after we've done hundreds of these cases a year for many, many years now, like 25 years, I think. And I can tell you that most of the people I deal with are not your stereotypes. I mean, in the U.S., for some reason, we have this stereotype of the kind of crazy psychopath, you know, spraying bullets and dressed in camos or whatever. And that really interferes with our ability to start prevention programs, because the bottom line is that most of the people I deal with during most of their lives, if they were sitting next to you in a waiting room somewhere or you ran into them on the street, would not look any different or out of the ordinary than anybody else. And so, that's why I want to focus on high-risk behaviors and all, as opposed to profiles or types of people, because it's not about types of people. It's not about profiles. It's about behaviors and, as you've pointed out, you know, quite rightly, the context of their lives. You know, and so many of these people that we deal with are entering a perfect storm of events in their lives, in the context of their lives, and within them that are all coming together to produce this potentially very dangerous situation. But many of them are not that extraordinarily different. And that's why sometimes I really cringe when we have these conversations like in gun control. There's this saying that we just need to get the guns in the hands of good people, not in the hands of bad people, as if the world is divided into good people and bad people. That isn't what happens, and that's not the case, and that's not who shoots each other, bad people, good people, and all that. That is as much as we would like to simplify it, it's not that simple.
But that's so seductive. That oversimplification is so seductive that there's good guys and bad guys, and if we make sure the good guys win and the bad guys lose, we'll be safe. It's dumb. We do the same thing in safety. Good workers and bad workers, get rid of the bad workers and the good workers will prevail. Well, you're right. It's not divided that way. It's just not. How?
Well, can I give you an example of that?
Sure.
It's like, and I downloaded some statistics the other day from the Department of Health and U.S. Department of Health, Department of Labor, and that kind of thing. If you take three risk factors, I'll take suicide, which is a high risk factor, because Columbine, Virginia Tech, Navy Yard, Sandy Hook, they're all suicidal events. So suicide's a huge risk factor in workplace violence. You take mental illness, not that all mental illness produces violence, but there are certain types of mental illness that may make someone more prone to be violent. And you take domestic violence, which, by the way, is huge. And it's about 40% of workplace violence. If you look at the statistics alone, just the statistics of those three things, 5% of Americans have attempted suicide in their lifetime. Now, that is probably an underestimate, by the way, because a lot of people don't admit to it, and there's probably a lot of failed attempts that are not identified as such. 5%. Every single year, 6% of the population is diagnosed with a severe mental illness. Severe means it incapacitates them. When you survey women, 25% of women say they have been physically abused by a significant other. So if you just take – and 10% of the population has had drug and alcohol problems. So if you just take those bare statistics, we're not talking about bad people. Those are high-risk factors that there's no environment, no work environment, no community in the world that can say, well, we don't have those in this here, you know? So that's what I'm talking about to a degree. You know, those are high risk factors that people have to pay attention to, not because they'll all end up being violent, but they all are problematic and they all are important because they do cause problems in society that we need to pay attention to. And they could end up being violent, or they're at least a higher risk of being violent as opposed to otherwise. So that's just an example.
But that's a conundrum. That's a really good example because all those people, and that's a big pile of people you just created there. All those people potentially qualify, but very few of them will actually act. And so you've got kind of the classic Platonic notion of uncertainty, the number of things that can go wrong versus the number of things that actually do go wrong. And that's a big part of it. So let's tip one more place, because you kind of alluded to this, and I think this is an interesting opportunity we should talk about while I got you. So you're having your big, you do a meeting every year where you bring in all your partners and you get together and you talk about cases, and I believe Stephen Covey would call it sharpening the saw. You workshop, and you want to open one of those days of the workshop up to anybody who wants to come in, people who have interest in this specific field, which is really where safety and kind of workplace violence, HR, comes together. I think that is a cool dang opportunity. So it begs two questions. One, well, let me state this first. It's going to be in May of this year, and that's cool, and it's going to be in Santa Fe, which is super convenient to me, at least. I'll go.
We're all staying at your house.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'll have to get some more towels, but I can do that. the two questions are, who should come to this, and why should they come? What do you think they'll get out of it, and who's the population you think that'll most benefit from it?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because the people that are going to most benefit from it, that'd be top priority, are those individuals within companies or within communities or within organizations, within workplaces, who have primary responsibility for identifying and responding and creating systems within their organizations to prevent and manage workplace violence. So who are they? You know, obviously, folks in security, folks in human resources and legal, but also as safety too. You know, it's one of the issues that I'm going to diverge just a little bit, is that for some reason, and I don't know why, maybe you can address this, is there some reason that I see this as a safety issue. I see this as a preventable safety issue, a core part of your safety program. And somehow I think it gets pushed out of that to other areas. And this needs to be a team approach. You can't do this well within an organization unless you have a team around it. And when I deal with these cases, that's what we do. We put together a team, if there isn't already one, where you have HR, you have legal, you have security, you have safety, and we're all talking about it, because it's all of these disciplines are important within the organization. Beyond that, I think anybody who has any interest in controlling workplace violence and managing and preventing it within their organization.
And what do they get out of it?
What they get out of it is several things. One is that understanding, first of all, on a global perspective, what they need to have in place. What are the primary ingredients that you need to have in place in your organization to be able to prevent workplace violence ultimately? And I think it will go beyond that, because what you'll also have is you will be dealing with these problems early in the process, and you'll – now, see, the problem is that by the time we get called in for workplace violence, we may prevent workplace violence. But, you know, the damage that this person and this issue has already done the workplace, sometimes for years, is huge. And it's not just the ultimate extreme version of violence, but there has the company has paid a cost that is so huge before you even get here. You know, if you have an overly aggressive person, if you had a suicidal person, if you have a person with some kind of mental illness, that cause all of these things will, you know, impact the workplace and are very costly. And again, so we'll talk about the ingredients that you need for a system and how to incorporate those, and also an understanding of the primary philosophy, if that's the right word, that we have in this situation in terms of way to look at this that will be much more effective in terms of preventing it.
And I'll be glad to jump up and let me talk with your guys a little bit about the whole systems approach, understanding kind of events, that whole prevention versus response idea, because that whole thing you said about coexisting is right where we are. I mean, that's a good fit. What are the dates exactly? I don't remember or have.
Well, I believe it's May 4th. Let me check really quick.
We can find this out. That's not
I do think May 4th sounds right, though.
Yeah, it's on a Thursday, May 4th, 2017. And again, I'm really excited about it, Todd, because this will give you and I a chance, you and me a chance to really combine what we do. Because again, your approach towards systems and context and understanding that, again, is a often a missing ingredient here that needs to be shared and incorporated in all this.
Cool. Got any final words for the gang?
Oh, maybe come visit us in Santa Fe, one of my favorite towns, and get a chance to visit the infamous Dr. Todd Conklin.
That's right, and we'll eat some chili, either red or green. Or maybe both.
Or Christmas.
Yeah, maybe both. We'll go to both. All right, sounds good, my friend. Thank you for your time.
I always enjoy it, Todd. Take care.
I enjoyed it immensely. So there you go. What a discussion, huh? I told you. A lot of stuff in there that really makes me interested. If you're interested in this topic, out of this kind of podcast rolled out this fact that he was bringing his staff to Santa Fe in May to actually do a meeting. And he said, we ought to do a workshop together. So we're thinking about doing a workshop. It's easy for me because I'm in Santa Fe. Think about it. If you want to go, it will be a discussion really around systems and threat assessment is what it'll be a discussion around. And I think it'll be a really good one. I would invite you to come. Who I'd tell you is think about who in your company would really benefit from sort of a good new view systems holistic approach and sort of an understanding of some opportunity to spend with Mark. If you think about doing it, I don't know, just toss it out there. It's pretty organic. It's kind of just what happened in this conversation. I think maybe I'm thinking about these, and that's why I talk about these. But either way, that's the podcast. Tell your friends. Our numbers are humongous. 200,000 listeners is getting crazy. But that's good. That's really super good, and I'm pleased to know it. Subscribe. Absolutely subscribe. That seems to make a huge difference. Write a review. That really helps us a lot. But mostly, just keep listening and keep contributing. That's what matters the most. Until then, my friends, I hope you learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.